The world and everything in it is made possible by listeners like us. Hi, I'm Orion. I live in Grand Rapids, Michigan, and I listen to The World and Everything in It every day before I start school. I hope you enjoyed today's program.
Good morning. Technology, online privacy, and the law. They often don't align to protect you.
So you want to be able to take advantage of the technology and not lose all of your privacy while doing so, because you kind of need both.
That's ahead on Legal Docket. Also, today the Monday Money Beat, retail sales up and a common measure of price inflation not up as much as expected. We'll talk about the meaning and the misconceptions. Plus, the World History Book, today the 25th anniversary of the Defense of Marriage Act.
I'm not for gay marriage. I think marriage is a sacred institution between a man and a woman.
It's Monday, September 20th. This is The World and Everything in It from listener-supported World Radio. I'm Mary Reichert.
And I'm Nick Eicher. Good morning.
Time now for the news. Here's Kent Covington.
The United States began flying migrants from Haiti back to their home country on Sunday. That after more than 10,000, mostly Haitian migrants, arrived en masse at the southern border. Gerline Joseph is a migrant advocate with the Haitian Bridge Alliance. She said those being flown back to Haiti really have nothing to return to.
People have literally been spending 5 months on a journey, dying on the way.
The U.S. government is citing the Title 42 policy adopted during the pandemic that allows officials to expel most would-be asylum seekers. Haitian migrants have been massing at the border for weeks. Some stopped and set up camp along the Rio Grande. Others simply found other ways into the country. Texas Governor Greg Abbott said border officials have been overwhelmed.
And they asked Texas Department of Public Safety if the Texas Department of Public Safety would be responsible for manning port, I think it was six ports of entry.
Officials on Sunday tried to block the Mexican border at an isolated Texas town where thousands of migrants have set up camp. About a dozen Texas Department of Public Safety vehicles lined up near the bridge and river where Haitians have been crossing into Del Rio, Texas, but the migrants quickly found other ways to cross nearby. The FDA could soon approve COVID-19 vaccines for children as young as five. National Institutes of Health Director Dr. Francis Collins said Sunday,
the data submitted by Pfizer to FDA for kids 5 to 11 is supposed to arrive in FDA's hands later this month. I know they will work 24/7 to go through it and try to assess whether it's time to grant an approval, and that will happen in weeks and not months.
He also predicts that booster shots will be available for most Americans in the next few weeks. A government advisory panel has recommended temporarily limiting a third shot of the Pfizer vaccine to people 65 and older and other high-risk Americans. But Collins told CBS's Face the Nation, I think there will be a decision in the coming weeks to extend boosters beyond high-risk individuals. Imal Emadi, a survivor of an errant U.S. drone strike that killed 10 members of his family in Afghanistan, is demanding accountability. On August 29th, a U.S. Hellfire missile struck the car that Emadi's brother had just pulled into the driveway of the Emadi family compound as children ran to greet him. Seven children died in the strike, including Emadi's three-year-old daughter, Malika. On Friday, U.S. Marine General Frank McKenzie called the strike a tragic mistake.
I am now convinced that as many as 10 civilians, including up to seven children, were tragically killed in that strike. Moreover, we now assess that it is unlikely that the vehicle and those who died were associated with ISIS-K or were a direct threat to U.S. forces.
Emadi said Washington's apology is not enough. The family is also seeking financial compensation and relocation to the United States or another country deemed safe. The U.S. military initially defended the strike. The Pentagon said it had targeted an Islamic State group's facilitator and disrupted the militants' ability to carry out attacks during the chaotic final stage of the withdrawal last month. Meantime, the Taliban continues to return to familiar patterns of subjugating women. Taliban officials in Kabul have told female employees in the city government to stay home. The city's new interim mayor said women will only be allowed to work if they cannot be replaced by men. The move is another sign that the Taliban, who overran Kabul last month, are once again enforcing their harsh interpretation of Islam despite initial promises by some that they would be more inclusive. In their previous rule in the 1990s, the Taliban had barred girls and women from schools, jobs, and public life. In recent days, the new Taliban government has issued several decrees rolling back the rights of girls and women. I'm Kent Covington, and straight ahead, legal protections for online privacy, plus sharing the Dead Sea Scrolls. This is The World and Everything in It.
It's The World and Everything in It for this 20th day of September 2021. We're so glad you've joined us today. Good morning. I'm Mary Reichert.
And I'm Nick Eicher. Time now for Legal Docket. Today, where your personal data and the law come together. Lots of electronic devices create and store personal data, especially personal fitness tracking devices, products like the Fitbit. It measures steps, heart rate, activity, sleep, and more. Now, lots of different parties covet this kind of information, including law enforcement. Police can use data on your personal trackers to investigate crimes, such as this one from 2018, one that ultimately led to an indictment.
The murder mystery took a dramatic turn when police took a closer look at the Fitbit tracker Navaja wore on her left wrist. Investigators say it showed her heart rate spiked at 3:20 p.m. on September 8th, then stopped a few minutes later, right before her stepfather left the house.
Solving crime is an upside to using digital footprints if used lawfully. Then there's cybercrime, one of the downsides.
Lockbit ransomware isn't a new technique we've seen from cybercriminals, but it is making a surge here lately this past summer, and it doesn't seem to be slowing down.
143 million people were affected by the Equifax data breach, and I was one of them.
The law has not kept up with rapidly changing technology. The U.S. Supreme Court has dealt with the problem in a piecemeal manner. Let's go back to 2014 during oral argument in a case called Riley v. California. Let's listen to the now retired Justice Anthony Kennedy.
What's wrong with think it's odd to say that we're living in a new world. Someone arrested for a minor crime has their whole existence exposed on this little device. And from your argument, you want us just to adopt a categorical rule. It's in the custody of the police. They can search it. Do you have any limiting principles that we should consider at all as a fallback position?
Yes.
Now, in that case, the justices agreed to this limiting principle, that during an arrest, police must get a warrant before searching the digital contents of a cell phone. So that decision drew some boundaries around law enforcement and privacy rights.
Well, it did, but I wanted to find out the general lay of the land beyond that. Kurt Opsahl is general counsel of the Electronic Frontier Foundation. It's a nonprofit dedicated to defending civil liberties in the digital age. First, Opsahl echoed Justice Kennedy.
Basically, your life is online at this point. For most people, they are using email, they're using cloud storage, they have a smartphone that is connected constantly, telling what they're, everything from like what they should pick up at the grocery store to when their appointments are. We've moved into an age in which so much of our lives are intertwined with the internet.
That intertwining is what makes drawing boundaries so difficult. But one way is by consent. What about my consent to use or not use my personal data?
Well, for everything that you're using, there probably was a privacy policy and a terms of service that have explained some things about how that data will be used. And if you tried to read each and every one of them before you used any given service online, you would spend your entire day reading privacy policies and terms of service and never actually using the products. But it's also beyond the capabilities of most people to really sort of keep track of all the possible information that can be collected and how it will be used. And a lot of that information, if it's stored online, might be a target for somebody who wants to have information.
Opsahl pointed to ECPA. That's an acronym that stands for the Electronic Communications Privacy Act, enacted back in the 1980s. Information stored online is somewhat protected by that law. Police can get that information with appropriate legal procedures, subpoenas, warrants, under ECPA with a court order, for example. But when the law cannot keep up with technology, absurdities result.
One of the issues with ECPA is that at the time, most people were downloading their email onto their computer and then taking it off of the server. And so the law had a notion in it that if you left your email on a server for 180 days, then you obviously didn't care about it, and they reduced the requirement for law enforcement to be able to access that information. And then, you know, you have things like Gmail comes about 20 years later, and everybody is keeping their email on a webmail server indefinitely. So this 6 month rule makes absolutely no sense for what ordinary people are doing.
One problem Opsahl sees is a lack of political will to put in more safeguards, as well as big tech trying to weaken proposed privacy protections that are made.
In addition, there are some other investigative tools, like a national security letter can be also used to get subscriber information, and that can be issued by the FBI for national security investigations even more easily than a subpoena. And it comes with an automatic gag order, one which we believe is unconstitutional, but it puts an automatic gag on the recipient to not tell people that they've received it. For foreign intelligence investigations, they can go to using the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, go to the special secret court that meets inside an electronically shielded room. The public is not allowed. And get an order to get information concerning foreign intelligence. So there's a lot of different ways that the government may seek information.
Opsahl sees some reform trickling in.
At this point, all the major service providers say that we will insist on warrants for content nationwide. So I think that issue has been greatly helped by, you know, over the last 30 years by service providers pushing back, courts agreeing. So I'm using this as an example of a long-time battle, but still be good to have some reform.
The COVID-19 era ushered in more privacy concerns. Contact tracing apps created by different states, for example, that send you a notification if it's likely you've been exposed to COVID.
It ended up being that there was a system that was proposed and fairly widely adopted from Apple and Google working together that would use a pretty secure Bluetooth notification system, which would not reveal people's identities. But there were still for a while a number of states who wanted to have ones which would do location tracking and give a whole bunch of information collected in the name of exposure notifications. Also seen some of the controversies around things like vaccine passports, where people would show proof of vaccine and sometimes were involving more things than just whether or not you had a vaccine and additional information that might be revealed.
This is an area of the law very much in flux. It leaves individuals vulnerable as technology rapidly changes and the terms and conditions for use remain unreasonably difficult to ascertain.
So you want to be able to take advantage of the technology and not lose all of your privacy while doing so, because you kind of need both. You want to make sure that the best protection you can have for your information is either that it wasn't collected in the first place, if it was collected, it wasn't stored, and if it was stored, it was encrypted where you have the key. So actually strengthening encryption is something we care a lot about and is a good defense to a lot of potential data leaks.
During my research, I read about the right to be forgotten. That is, the right to have private information removed from internet searches. The European Union, Argentina, and the Philippines have put this into practice in certain situations.
So the right to be forgotten, and there's sort of a related concept, sort of the right to erasure, it has some challenging aspects to it. There are instances in which the European sort of right to be forgotten was used to suppress information. So if a politician had some embarrassing things from the past that they didn't want the public to find out about before the vote, they would try to use the right to be forgotten to remove stories about their prior scandals and things like that. That really comes up against freedom of expression in the form of the people who wanted to say things about, you know, scandals in the past, for the public to receive that information so they can make an informed choice. The notion of a right to erasure has come up. If you give information to somebody, say, you know, Facebook, the right to erasure would be like, just go back to them and say, you know what, I'm removing my consent, please remove all of my data. And that is not quite being forgotten, which is to say that, like, to try and get it so that there is no mention of this anywhere, but rather that the information that you provided can be taken back.
But the United States does not have either the right to be forgotten or the right of erasure, although several individual states have considered measures like them. As the public becomes more vocal about privacy in light of so many data breaches, that could provide some momentum for change. Opsahl says change is what we need. Privacy by design, with protections baked in so that the average person need not make it a full-time job just to protect his or her own privacy. And that's this week's Legal Docket.
Additional support comes from Covenant College, a distinctly Christian liberal arts college on beautiful Lookout Mountain, Georgia. More at covenant.edu. From mission-focused Men for Christ Sunday Night Podcast, helping dads winsomely guide their kids into a biblical worldview. Mission-focused Men for Christ on your podcast app. And from whatwillthelearn.com, a free college search tool focused on what matters most, learning in the classroom. Only 24 colleges earn an A. More at whatwillthelearn.com.
All right, so imagine you're at the big box appliance store. You just found the perfect oven, the perfect fridge, the perfect whatever. So you buy that perfect whatever, and then you go home and realize as you go through the front door that that perfect thing you just bought won't make it through the front door. Yeah, buyer's remorse. Well, the Dutch military has a case of buyer's remorse, kind of like this, except multiplied by 1,600 times. The military ordered a new fleet of trucks to replace the outdated fleet, but what the brass forgot to do here was something we should never forget, and that is run it by legal.
Oh, double whoopsies.
Yeah, that's right. You always have to check with the lawyers. Turns out the maximum height for vehicles is a little over 13 feet. That's 4 meters. But the trucks the military bought were taller than 4 meters. Too big, so they can't use them. The moral of the story here, measure twice, cut once. As in, cut the check once. It's the world and everything in it.
Next up on The World and Everything in It, the Monday Money Beat.
Financial analyst and advisor David Bahnsen joins us now for our weekly conversation and commentary on markets and the economy. David, good morning to you.
Good morning, Nick. Good to be with you.
Well, David, we received a couple of government economic indicators, some reports for August, and I'd like to get your read on those. And one of them was the Consumer Price Index. Of course, that's a regular report from the Labor Department. You often hear referred to in media reports as inflation. Financial journalists will frequently interchange the term inflation and CPI, Consumer Price Index. That, of course, can be misleading if you're not careful. We'll get to that in just a minute. But I'd like to begin with consumer spending, that fraction of spending that happened in the nation's retailers, so retail sales. According to the Department of Commerce, August retail sales bounced back month on month over July, and it registered a 0.7 percentage point increase. Now, I think a lot of people will hear the headline or hear the lead sentence and take the meaning of the report from that. And I'd like to read a typical mainstream media econ story on that retail number. The U.S. economy, the story says, is proving resilient in the face of the Delta variant. Americans briskly increased spending at retailers last month, and then it goes on from there. So it seems like a suggestion of cause, that is retail sales growth and effect. Economic resilience.
Well, it's funny. I absolutely agree that the economy showed resilience through the Delta strain, and I don't think that the retail number is proof of that at all. So it's one of those cases where I think they're looking for evidence of a conclusion, and they have the conclusion right, and then the evidence is disconnected. I want to keep saying this, though, to the world listeners. America's economic strength does not come from its ability to spend money. It's a fallacy, but it is sort of the major economic fallacy of the last 100 years. On the government side, we believe we can fix economic problems by government spending more money. But on the household side, we believe economic strength comes from our ability to go buy things. And my contention is that economic strength is always and forever, since the Garden of Eden all the way to 2021, Silicon Valley, Wall Street, K Street, Hollywood. Economic strength is from production. And so despite the philosophical bias I have towards production, not consumption, which is both spiritual and economic for me, the retail number in America is absurd. There is no question that Americans are very happy to spend money as long as they can. And so whenever we have periods where consumption drops, the financial crisis, that 1 month of the COVID lockdown, things like that, it's always because of credit. It's not because demand went down. There's no less demand for food and beverage and vacations and toys and cars and electronics. It's just simply that the ability to spend more went away when the housing crisis kept people from being able to refinance out of their homes, when credit cards get maxed, when banks tighten, you know. And so I think that the retail number was a surprise to people because they expected auto sales to drop so much, which they did, that it would take the overall retail number down month over month. But second of all, the total retail number actually went higher by 0.7%, even with autos dropping, because people spent so much more money in malls, restaurants, et cetera. Well, I spent a lot of time in Southern California. I spent a lot of time in Manhattan. I'm in airplanes. I'm out and about. Yeah. I didn't see one iota of indication this summer that people were going, oh, my gosh, Delta strain, I'm not going to go spend money. And so the reality is that that narrative didn't make sense, and then the data just sort of smacked the narrative around this week a little bit.
Well, David, let's jump into that inflation question I mentioned a moment ago. The consumer price index for August, it ticked up, but it did so at a slower pace month on month from July and June. And again, we hear these reports and we hear this is a sign one way or the other that inflation is easing or rising. But the sense that it's easing kind of goes against a political narrative. We hear Republicans frequently decrying inflation, and you do see pockets of rising prices. But you make a distinction about the types of inflation and public policy choices that drive inflation. Could you address that?
Let me first address the issue about the politicians that are going to continue making hay of it. I happen to think they're doing something and saying something that's politically wise and advantageous, but I happen to think they're getting it wrong. But I don't think they know they're getting it wrong, so I'm not down on them. But certainly to the extent prices are elevated and it taps into an overall theme of attacking the competence of the current administration, I think that there's a lot of political wisdom in trying to hit the point home. But if one is talking in the world I'm in, which is about the actual soundness of the economic claim and projection, I just think there's no question you have rising prices in some areas for reasons that are not inflationary. And this isn't as much a debate as people say it is, because we continue to have the only data points we need to answer the question. As money supply went up last year significantly at first, it's still now up, projected about 6% money supply growth. Loan demand is still down 15%. And so there just isn't any proof of monetary inflation. But prices can go higher for other reasons than that. When there's a supply shortage, like we saw earlier in the year with lumber. Lumber skyrocketed up. It's now dropped over 70%. And I do think the better word to use this month was disinflationary than deflationary. Prices still rose on the month, but they rose at a much lower rate than they had been. And so as that rate of inflation is dropping, what we call disinflation, it will eventually change the political narrative. But in the meantime, I understand why whatever side of the fence, you know, would want to exploit the political data points. And I do believe that there are parts of policy creating pricing challenges. And the greatest example continues to be in housing. There's just simply no excuse for rates being so low, for the Fed buying so many mortgage bonds, stimulating more borrowing activity, and then combine that with more state and local supply problems in housing, environmental regulations, zoning issues that keep more housing stock from getting built, which the Biden administration is attempting to remedy some of that. I don't think their remedies are going to go anywhere. They don't have the authority at a federal level to do much here. It's a state and local problem. But housing is an area where I think you have inflationary problems. I just don't think it's monetary inflation. And so there's a lot of lanes to cover, and simplistic two-sentence, you know, kind of analysis that a lot of people want right now, inflation bad, Biden bad, you know, this, that, those things don't work in the present moment. We have to unpack it a little better to get this right.
Yeah. David Bahnsen, financial analyst and advisor. He writes at dividendcafe.com. That is your Monday Money Beat. David, thank you. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me, Nick.
Next up on The World and Everything, In It, the World History Book. Today, a few milestones from recent history and some from ancient history. Here is senior correspondent Katie Galtney.
Kicking things off today with a modern milestone that has ancient origins. 30 years ago, on September 22, 1991, the Dead Sea Scrolls became available to the public for the first time. The scrolls themselves were discovered by shepherds in the caves of Qumran in the Judean desert during the mid-1900s. No one knows for sure why they were in those caves, but biblical scholars consider that discovery one of the most important of the 20th century. Historian and filmmaker Dave Stotts of Drive Through History explained.
Here is why the Dead Sea Scrolls are so important. The scrolls contain an important history of the time, but more importantly, we can now compare the 2,000-year-old manuscripts with a copy of our modern Bible.
With little change from the text of ancient time to modern day, the scrolls help validate the Bible's textual authenticity. But it took decades more for those in possession of the scrolls to reproduce those important texts in manuscript form. And it didn't need to take so long. Scholars outside of the scroll bubble believed the small publication team was needlessly delaying the opportunity for others to review the work. Herschel Shanks of the Biblical Archaeology Society convinced a graduate student working closely with the scrolls to get bootleg images of the ancient papyrus.
The scrolls were kept secret for 40 years by a small group who had been assigned to publish them, and they hadn't. In the end, the scrolls were freed by underground photographs that we managed to get.
The result was the 1991 facsimile edition of the Dead Sea Scrolls. The publication spawned a surge in public interest in the scrolls, along with a lawsuit. A court ordered the Biblical Archaeology Society to pony up around $100,000 for the unauthorized facsimile. But Shank says it was worth it.
So that was the kind of the bittersweet ending, but everybody's friendly now.
And jumping ahead half a decade now to September 21st, 1996, when the U.S. Congress passed the Defense of Marriage Act, or DOMA. That act defined marriage as the union of one man and one woman for purposes of the federal government. It also allowed states to refuse to recognize same-sex marriages from other states. Socially conservative groups began vocally opposing same-sex marriage in the twilight years of the 1980s. Lawmakers Bob Barr and Don Nichols, both Republicans at the time, introduced the bill in May 1996. It passed both houses of Congress with a significant majority, making a presidential veto impossible. Clinton reluctantly signed the bill into law. In the ensuing years, DOMA remained a hot-button issue, vulnerable to legal challenges. Moderators often called on political candidates to make their position on the matter known.
I'm not for gay marriage. I think marriage is a sacred institution between a man and a woman.
I agree with that. But I think that we should find a way to allow some kind of civic unions.
I believe marriage is between a man and a woman. But I also believe that because we are the United States of America, you can't discriminate in the rights that you afford people.
I will tell Americans straight up that I don't support defining marriage as anything but between one man and one woman. And I think
years more of back and forth, a little dancing around the issue, with the left claiming nuance and entertaining the idea of exceptions, while the right invoked traditional and biblical values. And in 2012, a sea change when in May of that year, President Barack Obama became the first president to endorse making same-sex marriage legal.
I've been going through an evolution on this issue. For me personally, it is important for me to go ahead and affirm that I think same-sex couples should be able to get married.
The Supreme Court rendered DOMA unenforceable in its decisions on United States v. Windsor in 2013 and famously Obergefell v. Hodges in 2015. DOMA is now defunct. And our final entry, not too far a leap, either in time or in subject matter. It's been a decade since the U.S. military ended its Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy. Beginning on September 20th, 2011, the military permitted openly gay men and women to serve for the first time. In 1993, President Clinton signed a law directing military personnel not to ask, tell, pursue, or harass about fellow servicemen and women's sexual orientation. Over 18 years, the military discharged north of 13,000 troops under Don't Ask, Don't Tell. On the day of the repeal, Defense Secretary Leon Panetta said,
I believe we move closer to achieving the goal at the foundation of the values that America is all about.
Military chaplains worried the change would jeopardize their ability to adhere to a biblical view of sexuality. Others saw it as a slippery slope, wondering if lifting the ban on LGBT service members would lead to treating transgenderism as a civil rights issue rather than a medical or psychological condition. Many of those concerns have proven valid. For another decade after Obama signed the repeal, limitations on transgender people serving in the armed forces remained in place. But as of January 26, 2021, military officials removed those restrictions, even providing medical care to transitioning individuals. That's this week's History Book. I'm Katie Galtney.
Tomorrow, gas prices and U.S. oil production. One's going down, that is production, and that's pushing the other up, that is prices. We'll tell you the why of the supply squeeze. And electric vehicles. They're more popular than ever, but that might not be enough for car makers to hit their sales goals. That and more tomorrow. I'm Nick Eicher.
And I'm Mary Reichard. The world and everything in it comes to you from World Radio. World's mission is biblically objective journalism that informs, educates, and inspires. Reminder that we're offering free 30-day trials to World Watch. That's our daily TV news for students, great for homeschoolers and as a supplement to classroom work. Worldwatch.news. If you're insulted for the name of Christ, you're blessed because the Spirit of glory and of God rests upon you. If anyone suffers as a Christian, let him not be ashamed, but let him glorify God in that name. Go now, in grace and peace.